And we are live. Welcome everyone to the first of our virtual reactor series. I am excited to be the one that gets to kick off this season of programming that we're doing through the reactor now and in this virtual format because, well, we can't get together and do the content that we would normally be doing. But it also does give us this exciting opportunity to be able to present to our friends at the reactors all around the globe. So I know that we've got people in from San Fran and Seattle and probably other parts of the US have dialed in to check out this. And hopefully you've dialed into the correct session. My name is Aaron Powell, and we're going to be looking at Docker today. So just a quick introduction to those that haven't met me before or haven't seen any of my previous presentations. My name is Aaron Powell. I'm a developer advocate with Microsoft, part of the Cloud Advocates team. Primarily, I'm a web developer. That's what my background has been for the last 15 years. I've worked across a variety of different styles of organizations and from kind of ad-centric companies to consulting to all sorts of things like that. You can find me online at various locations. I'm on Twitter at Slace. I do a lot of blogging through aaronpowell.com, and there's my email address if you want to get in contact at some future point in time. But one thing that's always been core to the way that I've approached technical problems is that I like to be able to work out how things work. I always kind of tick around with the basics and work out what's the fundamental building blocks of something that I'm playing with so that when I'm talking to people about how to use something in their systems, I can understand the problems that it might solve and the places that it will fit into in a broader picture. And a couple of years ago, I was working at a consulting company and I was consulting to a company that was doing a major infrastructure refresh, and they were looking at ways to modernize a lot of very traditionally built web applications, and they thought that Docker was going to be a solution for them. They were interested to see how it could fit in to the kinds of problems that they were tackling as a business. So we started doing some research for them, and what they were finding when they were doing all this research into like how does Docker work and what kind of problems can it solve is there was a heap of different buzzwords that were getting thrown at them. Everything from containerization and microservices, immutable infrastructure, Kubernetes, and all sorts of stuff. And they were basically scratching their head going, well, what does all of this mean? Like, we don't quite know where Docker can fit into our problems. Like, they weren't even sure if Docker was going to be the right tool for what they were trying to solve. And then they've got all these things that are getting thrown at them. So they were very, very confused about the role that Docker could play. So today's talk is going to be about none of that stuff. In today's talk, we're going to focus on the basics when it comes to Docker. So this is for people that might never have played with Docker or it's been on their radar of things to learn and stuff like that. Ultimately, we're going to be starting from scratch with Docker. So like I said, if you've never played with Docker or it's always it's something that you've installed but you've never got to really touch or work out what you could use it for, this is the talk for you. At least I hope this is the talk for you. Now, before we jump in and actually start working with Docker and looking at some of the things, I want to make sure that we cover off some of the terminology so that we're all on the same page when I'm explaining things as we go along through the demos. Now, first off, Docker is not a virtual machine. It's the concept of containerization, which has actually been, it actually grew out of Linux. And it's been in Linux and Unix-based systems for a very long time. It relies on a bunch of things that can be done at the kernel level with a Unix and Linux based machine around things like C groups and namespacing and ultimately it's process isolation. So we put a process in a container. So that's where the idea of containerization or the terminology of containerization comes from, is that we take a process and we put it in this little box that allows us to run that process highly isolated from the rest of the machine. It still shares a lot of stuff with the machine if we allow it to be shared, but fundamentally it's completely isolated. So that is what we call an image. An image is your starting point. It's the thing that you might produce as output from a build server. It's the thing that you would be downloading from a container registry. It's the immutable object that you pass around that represents an application that you want to be running. Now, in terms of like a programming concept and like I like to use an OO programming analogy of it. An image is kind of like a class definition. It's something that you start with and then you create instances of. And those instances are the containers. A container is a running image. So it's an image that we start up. We add a writable file system to it. So where an image is immutable, a container is mutable because it has a mutable file system layer added to it. And this is the thing that your process is executing with inside of. We can put in all the processes that we're going to need into our container, and then into our image, and then we can run those when our container starts up. And then finally, we have our host, the thing that Docker is installed on, and the thing that will be sharing its kernel with the Docker containers that are running. Now, traditionally, Docker came out of Linux environments. So the kernel that was shared was a Linux kernel. I'm actually going to be doing the demos today in WSL2, so it is going to be running in Linux, but I run Windows as my host OS. So technically my host is going to be Linux, even though I might orchestrate that from Windows. If you're using Docker for Windows rather than WSL, you will still deploy a virtual machine, but that is so that you can run a Linux VM and then you do everything on a Linux VM. That's why I guess it can be a little bit confusing that Docker isn't a virtual machine, but you still might be running a virtual machine. The same goes if you're running it on a Mac. You'll be running a Linux virtual machine inside a VirtualBox. That is how you communicate with Docker. If I was running a Windows containers though, a Windows Server Windows Nano Server or Windows Server as the base image, then I could be deploying that onto a Windows Server instance inside of Azure in AKS or ACIs, Azure Container Services or Azure Container Instances. I'm sharing the Windows kernel there. If I'm doing Windows containers on a Windows 10 machine, then they're going to be running a virtualized version of Windows Server because the Windows 10 kernel is slightly different from the Windows Server kernel. Now with Docker, we work predominantly on the command line. So the command that we're going to start with is Docker. That's the CLI that we'll be working with. We then provide it with a series of there's a bunch of different commands we can provide, such as run. So I want to run a container from an image. I then can provide it with a series of options, -it. In this case, I'm providing it -it and -rm. -it says it's going to be an interactive container, so I can connect to it and connect to the standard input and enter commands. And -rm tells this container when it stops, it will then clean up after itself. Finally, we will provide some arguments to the command that's going to be run. In this case, the run command expects an argument of the image name, Ubuntu, and optionally a entry point or a command to execute when this container starts up. So I'm just going to default it into the bin bash shell when we kick off this container in its execution. Sounds like there is a truck outside my window. The joys of doing remote presentations is that we've got to deal with all the things that happen in our home environment. And yes, a truck has pulled up directly outside my front door, and that's possibly some background noise that you can hear. Anyway, moving on, we're actually going to jump over, because that's enough slides, to the command line, and we're going to work with Docker. The exercises that I'm going to go through today, you can find on my GitHub at github.com/AaronPowell/Docker-from-scratch. We've got 14 live demos that we're going to go through, so it's time to get cracking. Now, to make things work a little bit faster and save me typing out a whole bunch of stuff, I've created an alias inside of Linux, which will execute this run.sh that I've got open here in VS Code. And I've just aliased that to R. So you'll just see me hit R enter, and that will execute the command rather than watching me mistype the word run multiple times, because I can guarantee you I can do that pretty well. Now, for this, we're going to kick off the Ubuntu container like we had in our slides just before. Got to execute Docker with the run command -it until it's interactive. I'm also passing through platform Linux as an option, and this is as an argument, and that's because I've got my machine set up so that I can run Linux or Windows containers through Docker for Windows and Docker for Linux. So I have to specify the platform. Now, if you're just targeting one operating system, you don't need to provide that. Then I'm saying that I want Ubuntu, and bin bash is going to be what I execute. So we'll come over here, we'll hit R, and it's going to run that example. And in a moment, you'll see that I drop into a slightly different shell prompt. Now, this is my container. So if I hit ls, you'll see it's a Linux file system. I can do ls-la, and I can see file system attributes on things. I could echo, hello, everyone, and then redirect that out to temp.txt. Ls, and we'll see that there's a file's now written to our file system. And then if I was to type exit, I will exit out of that shell, and I'll be dropped back to my parent, which we can see here. Now let's run a different Docker command. And this time we're going to use docker ps, which is going to list all the running containers that I have on my machine. I have no containers running because I just exited out of that one. So instead, if I was to do ps-a, so I list all the running containers, all the stopped containers, all the containers in any other state that they may be. And we'll see here, here is our one that we just ran, the Ubuntu one. We see that it was created 51 seconds ago and it exited 21 seconds ago. It's got a container ID and a name and a bit of other information I can look at. Now that's useful, particularly the container ID and the name, because I could grab this container ID, copy that, and then do docker start and then provide it with the container ID. Alternatively, I could give it the container name if I wanted. I hit docker start, and then this is going to start up that container again. If we do docker ps, we'll see that that's running. It was created a minute ago, but it's been up for 3 seconds. Now I could do docker attach, right with our container ID again. And we're going to connect onto that container and do ls, and we'll see, there we go. There's that file. I'm just going to split my shell, pop over a new one over here. And if we were to do something like docker logs dash f, so to follow the logs, give it the container ID. I can see these are all the commands that have happened, all the stuff that's been written to standard output for that container. Drop back over here, and if it ls again, you see it's updating logs, cat of temp, oops, temp.txt. And we get the output there, all sorts of things. So I can track what's happening with inside of my container in real time by looking at its logs. Now, if I want to stop a container, I just need to exit out of the process that's happening in there. So I can type exit with inside of my shell, or if I stop monitoring the logs, I can tell it to exit with docker stop, and then we'll say stop of that process. Sorry, stop of that container ID, and that's going to send the appropriate exit signal across to the container. It's stopped. It's removed. Close off my other shell and docker ps. Dash A, we can see that it's there, it's in an exited status. And then finally, I can do docker rm and provide it with the container ID to remove that container once it has, once I no longer need it. So let's now jump forward to the next one. And we'll have a look at, oops, not my slides. I want to go back to VS Code. All right, so here in VS Code, I've got a bunch more commands that I'm going to be executing. I'm going to run the same docker run, but I'm going to run it 3 times. There's one difference here that I've got is that I'm using dash d or dash dash daemon to execute this container and not attach directly to it. This could be useful if I want to run a container and then I want it to be interactive, but I don't want to be currently interacting with it. I might want to come back to it. And that's what I'm going to do in this case. I'm also providing a dash dash name argument, because I want to customize the name instead of letting it auto-generate for me. So now if we come back over to our shell, just drop back up to the top here, run, we'll see that we're going to start up 3 containers now. Each of them are going to have a unique ID, and I'm going to split my terminal again. I'm going to split it a couple of times because we're going to attach to each of those. It's going to take a moment because it's starting all of them plus splitting terminals, plus starting up 3 new shells. So give us a second while it runs, and I'm going to grab a drink so I can clear my throat. All right, there we go. I'm going to do docker attach. So like I said, we can attach with the container ID or the name. So Ubuntu 3, docker attach Ubuntu 2, and finally docker attach Ubuntu 1. And oops, if we come back over here, docker ps, we'll see that we have all 3 of them running. They're all created at slightly different intervals to each other. And if we have a look on each of them individually, they have their own file. Oops, not docker. I wanted just ls. They each have their own file system. And if we do our echo hello everyone and redirect that to temp.txt, We ls here. We'll see it's in Ubuntu 3, but if I go to ls on Ubuntu 2, it's not there. Now, while all of these have started from the same image, the writable file system layer that we've added is unique to them. So anything that I add in one container is not available in another container. Now, like I said, we can do docker stop on like Ubuntu 1, and that will send the appropriate sig term exit signal through to the process. So in this case, it's a shell, so it so it sends through exit. But if it was like a Node application or a .NET application or whatever it might be, it'll send the appropriate kill command to those. So it will gracefully exit, clean up any resources that connection might have open, like if we were talking to a database server or something like that. And we could also do docker kill and then provide it, say, Ubuntu 2. That's not how we spell Ubuntu, Ubuntu 2. And this will send it'll send a hard exit. So it's not going to gracefully exit. It's just going to terminate that process, kind of like a kill the dash line or something that you might do in a Unix system. And then I can do docker kill on Ubuntu 3. That's going to clean that last one up as well. Kill's fine in these kind of ones where I don't care about any potentially open pipes or anything like that, but you probably want to gracefully exit normally. Now, if we do docker ps-a, right, so we come back, -a, those have all gone. We have nothing left in our containers because I set them as -rm, which means that when they were exited, they removed themselves from my container list. All right, now we'll jump forward again in time. Step 3. So something that I like to do with Docker containers is that is use them for maybe a process that I want to run or play around with that I'm not committed to installing. I've been doing stuff on Windows for nearly 20 years now, and while I kind of trust an uninstaller to maybe delete the executable, I don't trust an uninstaller to remove everything out of the registry, to probably clean up any temp files. Like, there is always stuff left over when I do an uninstall process. So I was doing at my previous company, I was doing technical interviews for potential candidates, and that involved them doing a take-home exercise, and then we would do a review of it with them. But the one time a candidate sent me through a .rar file of their exercise that they'd completed. Now, I my WinRAR trial had expired, and like any good person would do, I had uninstalled WinRAR because I wasn't going to use it beyond the trial period, was I? I don't have 7-zip. I don't have like anything. What's wrong with zip as an archiving format? I just use that and it just works. So instead, I just tended to not worry about. Sorry, I forgot to put my phone on silent, and I'm getting a phone call. There we go. Ha! The joys of presenting from home again. Anyway, so as I was saying, I needed to unrar this file so that I could talk to the candidate about it, but I couldn't do that easily because I didn't have any RAR programs installed. So I did what any good over-engineering solution should do: is I went out and found a RAR image on the Docker registry and pulled it down. But I still had one other problem. I needed to get the RAR file from my host machine into the container that's running, but it's got its own file system. And we do that. It's something that's definitely doable in Docker, and we can do that with volumes. And that's what you'll see here with the -v or --volume argument that I can provide. With a volume, we need to provide it with two parts of the path. First is the path on the host. In this case, it's $pwd because it's the current working directory, and then colon location on our containers file system. So I'm just putting this into a folder called slash files at the root. So that's going to be at the root of the file system. Let's kick that off. We'll see what happens. It's going to execute the unrar. It's unpacking it. Don't worry, this isn't the candidate's code. This is another RAR file that I had in my emails. So I'm not sharing anyone's code. This was stuff that was previously up on CodeFlex, I think, or maybe GitHub. I don't know if it ever actually got migrated. It was a project that we used to work on at my last company. Anyway, so that's unrarred, extracted all those files out. And if we come back to VS Code, see, now I have a trunk folder, and then I have all of these files that listed with inside of that. And that's because when I do a volume mount, by default, it's a read-write mount. So I can put files in there from my host that can be accessed by my container, and my container can then write back to my host by using that same volume. You can do read-only volumes, but volumes are a very common thing you'll be doing with containers, particularly if you like have a some kind of service where you want to be able to pull back the log files, drop them in a location that you're then going to ingest them into our logging system elsewhere. You would mount a volume that you can push those out into. All right. Now we can use Docker to do like volume mounting and kind of a single use container. Because now, like once it's removed, once it's cleaned up after itself, I don't have to worry about like latency points of like an UNRWA program left on my machine. I no longer have access to UNRWA. But another use case could be you want to prototype with a new programming language, or you want to play with a new platform. So here, I'm just going to start this one up. Here I want to run a Node application. Maybe I want to experiment with those, see if it's going to be useful, or maybe I want to trial out one of the new builds of Node. I want to try out Node 13 and some of the features there, but I'm not wanting to install that and worry about swapping versions, or we're not ready to migrate that on our core application. Similarly, I do this with the .NET preview frameworks. Rather than installing a preview framework, I will download a Docker image that contains that preview framework and do my development in there. So I've just run this container. It's dropped me straight at a Node shell. So I can do like console.log, hello. And now I'm just writing plain old JavaScript. I can this is like a really old version, so I'm not sure if I got let in const. So we'll just do var fs equals require fs. And we'll do fs.readersync slash, and then we'll do function error files. And then we can console dot log files. There is going to be some live typing that you get to watch, and it's hopefully not going to be too painful. But there we go. This is just like I can write Node code in here and like test around with it. But I'm in the Node shell, so that's great if I just want to run commands straight off Node. But if I want to build an application, well, let's have a look at how we can do that. Now we'll step forward again. Now, I don't want to have to try and convince anyone to become like a Node programmer or anything like that. So I have an application here. Don't worry if you're not familiar with Node. It's a pretty simple application. All I'm doing here is creating a web server. It's going to be listening on port 3000. And when I hit it, regardless of what path I hit, it's just going to return me a hello world as a text response. I'm going to be doing a volume mount here, and then I'm going to be executing the Node app. I'm also specifying the working directory when the container starts running. So -W is working directory. Alternatively, I didn't have to specify the working directory, and I would have done /src/app in the command to execute. So I'm going to run that up, and excellent. It's starting up. The container is up and running in a moment. Let's just check. Cool. Docker PS. Excellent. It's been up for 6 seconds. And then we're just going to do curl and curl HTTP localhost colon. How would I say is on 3000. Boom. Yay for live demos. Demo file. So that's a good start. Let's just docker logs -f. I called it node, didn't I? Yep. Okay, cool. Server is up and running. Let's just split. So I can run curl, see if we get anything in there. Curl. Nothing in the logs. Okay, so I do actually know why this is failing. It's a design failure with inside of the talk. Now, so this gives me the opportunity though to show you something useful, because I haven't actually got a port that I can connect to. So if we go Docker PS and have a look at the what the output is there, we'll see that there is ports over on the side, but I have no ports. Although it expects ports, it doesn't have any ports. Or we can do Docker inspect node. So I can have a look at the config of that container while it's running. And now if we have a look, so we have a networking here and we've got the network that it's connected to, excellent. But if we scroll up a little bit, will see that there are no ports. Despite the fact that my application wants a port, I've never actually told the host that there is an available port. So let's just do docker kill node. I don't need it to gracefully shut down. And we're going to do docker checkout, git checkout step 6. Jump forward in time and we'll come back. So when we run an application that is going to need port access, so like a web server or like a socket server or anything like that, we need to make sure that we bind ports when we run that container. Here we use -p to bind the ports, and it works similar to the way that we do a volume mount. We do port on our host to the port on our container. Now, this is useful because our container might expose multiple ports, or we might have multiple containers that want to listen on the exact same port. But our host just says, well, you might want port 3000, but I'm going to give you port 8080 when I'm connected through, and the Docker networking will take care of that routing for you. So now if we do Docker, now if we run the application, we do docker ps and have a look at the output that we get here. Now we'll see that there is a port. It's going to be forwarding from the local address 8000 through to port 3000 on TCP. We can do UDP port bindings as well if we want. And if we do docker inspect on node, we will find the port bindings just up a bit here. Here we go. Here's our port bindings under network settings. We'll see the host IP and the port that's bound to, and then that's port 3000 on TCP. And if I do curl HTTP and on 8080, now we get back the response we were expecting. Excellent. So we've bound ports. It's all working, doing everything that we expect it to do. Let's kill that, and then we can jump forward to our next demo, because so far we've been doing everything just by running Docker run to start up our containers from our images, and then using volume mounts to push files in there and all that sort of stuff. Git checkout step 7. But that's great for works on my machine, but what if I want to make it work on everyone else's machine? That's where an image comes into play. And for an image, we need a Docker file. Well, the easiest way at least to make an image is with a Docker file. So a Docker file is a set of instructions that Docker build, it's going to be a new command we'll look at in a moment, takes to then build up a bunch of layers that results in our immutable image that we then can turn into a container and run with. So a Docker file will always start with run. A Docker file will always start with from. From is going to be the image that we're using as a base. In this case, I'm using node, and then I'm specifying a particular tag, which is the 774-alpine. So it's the node runtime version 7.7.4, and Alpine is just a flavor of Linux that I'm going to be using for this. It's just a very small one compared to the Ubuntu base. So that's going to be our base. So we're going to be adding layers onto that to represent our new application. We're going to say that this container, this image, when run as a container, expects port 3000 to be bound to something on the host. So we're exposing port 3000 from this container. And then we're going to execute a couple other commands. We're going to run a command, copy files in, set the working directory, and finally the command to execute when you start your container. So if we jump back to our run file, we see that we have a new one, which is docker build here on line 5. Docker build, and then we need to provide it with a tag for the image that we're going to produce. So I just tag as node.js-app, and then the location of the Docker file. We don't have to specify the file name of Docker file, it looks for that by convention, but if you're using file names other than Docker file, you need to also specify that. And then finally, we can do docker run. And then this time, I only need to bind the ports, and then say the image I want to run is node.js-app, which is the one that we're creating just above. Hit run. Kick this off, and we'll see a bunch of new output. We'll see there's a whole bunch of steps that it's that's executing. You'll notice that it says using cache, and that's because I've actually executed this before. So I'm just to show how it all works, I'm going to just kill the node container that we've just started up there. Whoops, what did I call it? Did I give it a name? I did not give it a name. So I need to kill 986, kill that by ID. And then I'm going to docker images. Actually, we'll do docker rmi and node.js app. I'll come back and talk about what RMI does in a little bit, but I just want to show you the output that you would normally get when you run a Docker run. Docker build. Okay, so now we're going through and we're creating a whole bunch of new layers, which essentially it's actually starting containers. It adds a layer for that container, executes whatever that container has to do, removes the container, and then passes it on to the next step. So it's taken a little bit longer that time, as we can tell. And we'll see that all the steps, there was six steps that we had with inside of our Docker file, the from, expose, et cetera, et cetera. Now it's up and running. Now, what that's done is it created me a new image. So if I do Docker images, we'll see this in my image registry. See here, Node.js-app. There is the ID of the image. It was created 24 seconds ago, and it has a file size of about 60 meg, and that's our application. I can do Docker PS. We see our application is now running, and it's running off the image Node.js app instead of running off Ubuntu with a bunch of commands. We can do curl 8000, and it's going to return our application just as we were expecting. So it's the same application. It doesn't do anything different to our previous demos. But instead, I have an image now I could publish to a container registry and then pull down elsewhere. So let's just kill B27, which is that one there. And then we're going to remove the image, and we're going to remove a couple other images that we're going to need later on, because I forgot to remove them after doing my dry runs earlier today. Docker RMI, so remove image instead of Docker RM, which is remove container, and Node.js app, step 11 and step 12. So we'll just clean all of those up. Cool, clear that when it's done, and we will check out step. What are we up to? I think we're up to 7. We're jumping through to step 8. Now with Docker, we often want to represent a maybe more complex environment. Like these are single apps or like single commands that we've been running so far. But what if you wanted to represent a more complex environment? That's where the tool Docker Compose comes in. Docker Compose is a standalone tool from Docker. It comes bundled with Docker for Windows and I think Docker for Mac, but on Linux, you have to install Docker Compose separately. And what Docker Compose does is it looks for a YAML file with Docker Compose as the file name convention. And inside of that, we define the things that we need for our Docker environment. We define services, we define networks, we define volumes and a bunch of other stuff. Services are the things that we want to run. So in this case, I'm defining a node service. I'm saying that it's going to use an image with some ports bound, volumes mounted, working directory commands, et cetera, et cetera. So this is equivalent of the Docker run command that we have done previously. Let's kick that off and have a look at how we're executing that. So we use Docker Compose. We're going to compose from the docker-compose.yaml file. We're going to bring up the environment, and specifically we want to bring up the service called node. And then that's going to be running until I terminate Docker Compose. And when Docker Compose exits, it's just going to Docker RM and just like nuke everything from orbit. So let's have a look. There we go. That's up and running. We'll split our terminal so we can have a look. If we do Docker PS, we'll see what's executing in here when my shell wants to come up. There we go. It's running. It's using the Node 774 Alpine. It's got the application and kind of all of the stuff that we've expected. I'm not going to run this because we've seen the Hello World response. And if you want to see, confirm that that does actually give you Hello World as a response when you do a curl, you can have a look at the demos and play with them yourself as well. So that's going to stop. It's going to clean up the containers and clean up the images and all that sort of stuff as it shuts down my environment, removing everything. Taking a little bit longer than I would have liked. Now I have to tap dance around. Cool. Okay, so we're going to check out step 9. So while we can use Docker Compose to orchestrate a Docker run command, we can also use it to orchestrate a Docker file. So this is similar to what we had on step 7, where we were doing Docker build and Docker run. In this case, we're just specifying that we want to this service is going to build from the current directory. That's the location. You will find a Docker file and then the port binding that we need. And then the Docker file is the same that we had before. Expose, run, copy, work directory, from, etc. It's all that same file. We won't run that one because, again, the demo is not particularly different to what we've seen. So we'll just instead jump forward to a new demo with a new set of containers. It's going to be step 10. So this time with the Docker Compose file, I wanted to show you how we could stand up something that requires environment variables. This time I want to run a SQL Server. I actually haven't installed SQL Server or Mongo or Redis, kind of like any sort of storage or even like cache style storage. I don't install those on my machine anymore. Instead, I just run them as Docker containers. But sometimes I'm going to need to provide environment variables. In this case, I'm standing up a SQL Server. This is from the Microsoft SQL Server Linux image. So this is a version of MS SQL Server that runs on Linux. I need to provide with some environment variables when it starts up. I need to accept the EULA, the license agreement, and I need to give it a SA password. Now, unfortunately, I've just broadcast what my super strong SA password is to the whole of the internet by putting it on this broadcast. But I think that that's fine because it's also checked into a Git repo. We'll start that one up, and this one's actually going to take a little bit of time because, well, it takes a bit of time to start up a SQL Server. It's a lot more complex than any of the applications that we've previously run. I'm going to fire up a tool so that we can have a look what's in the SQL Server. I'm going to use LinkPad. That's my favorite SQL Server exploration tool. I don't actually run like SQL Management Studio or anything like that. Instead, I just use LinkPad because then I can write like C# code, F# code against databases if I need to do any sorts of exploration. So the SQL Server will take a couple of minutes because, like I said, it's a lot more complex. And this image itself is it's over a gig download. It's a full-blown SQL Server. Now, a thing to be aware, though, is that this is a fully self-contained database. So what's happening is that anything that I'm creating with inside of that database is just with inside of that container. So if I was to put data in it and want to write to it and stuff like that, well, I need to make sure that I'm mounting those files, the output file somewhere as on a volume that I then have that persisted. Because otherwise, it's not going to exist for more than the lifetime of this container. But that also has a very positive effect. Let's say that you wanted to use like some integration tests where you were going to be reading and writing from a database. Well, you could actually run that in a container, and you have your database fully in a container. So when the test run shuts down, that data is gone, and you don't have to worry about like one test running data that another test has to make sure doesn't already exist and things like that. We're trying to connect to our SQL Server. It hasn't connected properly. And that's possible because I have a new IP address for my Docker, for my WSL instance. So let's just check out what my IP address is. The one thing I always forget to start up is LinkPad and check my SQL Server connection beforehand. Okay, so here is my IP address on my home network. My IP address changed from when I did my dry runs. Let's update my connection, test, make sure that we connect. Otherwise, it's going to be a very short demo against the SQL Server. Excellent. That has worked. We'll save that. Now it's going to connect in. Fantastic. I have a blank SQL Server. Let's collapse my terminal. Pop over here and let's create some stuff inside of my database. So we're going to create a new, where's LinkPad gone? Here you are. Let's execute some SQL commands. I'm going to create a new database called Docker Stuff. If I connect to the right one, there we go. Set my connection, there we go. We'll create database Docker Stuff. Any moment that's going to return. Obviously, this is going to be a little bit slower than running things on bare metal because at least in Windows, my SQL Server is running on a virtual machine for WSL2. And while it is pretty well optimized, it's still going to be not as fast as just like installing a SQL Server locally. But like I said, there are definite advantages to having that. Excellent. So there's my Docker Stuff database has been created. Let's pop back over here and let's create a table inside of that. These things pre-scripted because I can never remember how to create a SQL table from scratch. And then finally, we're going to execute a query against that. So I grab a chunk of code here, pop that in as a C# block, do against the Docker Stuff. Did you not copy when I said Control C? Copy. Paste. There we go. Excellent. Okay. So just to kind of prove out, so our table has been created. Fantastic. Just refresh the connection through to my SQL database, and then I can then it's just a SQL database. Like I could be connected to this from any kind of application. Obviously, I've got my my little application here that I maybe did, yeah, query executed successfully. Cool. I'm not sure why that hasn't refreshed properly. No, I know why that happened, because I put it into the master database instead of into the Docker stuff. whoops. So the master, I just modified my master database on my database server. Fantastic. Anyway, slightly right database, run it again. We'll see that we can insert some data. We can query it. Fantastic. Like, so this is just an application now talking to a SQL database. It has no idea that it's inside of its container or not. Let's terminate that. It's going to clear everything up, hopefully nice and simply, and we will wait for that to shut down. So then, like I said, that's going to delete all my data. We've got to remember that if we're using this as our local development database, you might spend a lot of time standing up data that you previously didn't need to stand up. Okay. So let's jump forward to number 11. Now is what I really want to show you how we can do a fairly standard sort of environment setup. And we can do that with an application that I've got here. I just close off all of these tabs. So I've got an application that I've created as a .NET Core application. This I simply went into Visual Studio, went file new web application, and enabled the Docker features with it. So it's generated me a Docker Compose file because it's representing an environment. So here it's going to be standing up a service called Demo App, which is my web application. There's the information around how it's going to build and all that sort of stuff. And then it's also, I've also modified this to stand up a SQL server. So this SQL server is using our MS SQL thing. It's got our things that we've all also set up. But this Docker Compose file, now when I stand up that environment, it will stand up both containers and then they can talk to each other. Now, like a traditional web application, a web application that talks to a SQL server. But I wanted to show how you could do that from the command line if you didn't want to use Docker Compose. So I'll kick this off because it's going to take a moment while to do the build and everything. So this is going to do our .NET restore, .NET publish. So it's going to build our application. And then it's going to create a new image. And let's open up that Docker file. Docker file. So this Docker file uses the ASP.NET Core 1.1. So I haven't actually updated the version of the ASP.NET application since I first created these exercises a while ago. So that's why it's using a very old one. But we also have a new directive that we're, or a new command that we're putting into our Docker file. This is arg. Arg says that I'm expecting you to provide me some information at build time when we're creating our image that helps with the thing that we're creating. We're using that down here on the copy line, here on line 5, inside of dollars, open and close curly brackets, which is the name of that arg, or I've got a colon and then some stuff after it. That is just saying, if I don't provide the argument, here is the default value that you should be using. So this is, and this is basically telling it where to copy the files into that image when it's created. So if we go back to our run file, we'll see that we provide build args, which is here. And the arg name is source, and then the path that I want to provide in. Set up the step. I create some networks. I put the containers into those networks, and then everything is up and running. It should be up and running by now. Oh, no, we're still creating our image. That's taking a little bit. There we go. Cool. We've successfully stood everything up. It's all going fantastic. It's up and running. And yep. I jump over to a browser. I can fire this web application up up there, and also just refresh LeetPad because we're reusing. We created a new database, but it's going to be on the same IP address and port because that's what I've exposed. But this database is going to be completely empty because it was a brand new database that was created. Yeah, I was sure that I said open a browser. It's going to be opening at some point in the future. Awesome. My SQL Server connection has decided not to connect. Yay! I think we're running to the end of what our live coding wants to provide for us. Yeah. The demo gods had been doing so nicely. It's probably the SQL Server is probably not finished provisioning behind the scenes. Okay, great. So now it looks like I've got two browser windows that are opening up. I should have left one up earlier today. We don't need both of them running, so let's just kill one of these. There, localhost port 1337, because that's where I decided to run this port set from. Refresh. Hopefully my SQL database has stood up by now. Yes, it has. Let's just refresh that to make sure that the person table is actually gone, which it should. Oh, sweet. We crashed LinkPad. Let's just refresh that. All right, cool. Well, ignore the fact that LinkPad has crashed because it's not particularly critical to the demo. What is critical to the demo is the fact that my browser is deciding to be exceptionally time poor in getting everything up and running. Any minute now, we should be able to see our web application. This web application has an authenticated component to it, so I need to be able to register an account, and then for the account to be able to be registered, it needs to be able to talk to the SQL Server. Here we go. Fantastic. We will click register. Let's take me through to my registration page, and if I type in an email address at microsoft.com, a secret password, and I think I got them both. I knew I was going to stuff that up. We'll hit register. Now, because this is a completely empty database that I've just stood up, the database tables that are required for the account to be provisioned haven't been created yet. So it's bringing me back an error going, well, hang on a sec. I've connected to the database with the credentials, but the table, I've connected to the server with the credentials, but the database you want me to open doesn't exist. Because this is a .NET Core application, it's got EF Code First Migrations enabled. So I can click Apply Migrations, which is going to talk to the SQL Server. It's going to stand up the tables and the database that we need. If I do a refresh, that'll be there in a moment or two. There we go. Cool. That's done. It's creating all of our tables. The browser is it's now saying that I can refresh the page because the migration has been completed. Resubmit that form. And ThinkPad still populated the table list. But what we'll see now is we now have a successfully authenticated and logged in account. Fantastic. Like, and we've done that without having to go in somewhere and like use an external tool to write to our database tables. I'm not going to worry about LinkPad trying to populate because I was going to show that the table's there and there's got data in them. But you can see that by the fact that I was able to successfully log in. So let's just clean up this demo and we'll jump through to the next one. Because there's one thing that we've done with the way that we set up this environment, like this web application SQL Server design, that is probably not ideal. Step 12. And what's not ideal about that is that I can talk to my SQL Server from anywhere, like anywhere that has a network connection and is on the same network as it. So you can imagine if this is a production environment, oh, look, it's finally decided to load in after I've already removed my SQL Server. Let's just start running that one while we talk about what's happening this time. So traditionally, or like normally when you're setting up a web application and like databases and other resources, you probably want to set up like a DMZ where you have the resources that need like a level of security or you shouldn't have publicly accessible. You don't make them publicly accessible. There's no point in making them publicly accessible if they should, if they don't need to be. So in the example of a SQL Server or like a database server, you don't want your database server accessible via anyone that can on the internet because that doesn't make sense. It's not, you don't need to have that, and you've just created an attack vector for your environment. So that's where Docker networking can come in. So we're doing the same .NET Core application and we build and publish and set up an image. And this time I'm creating two networks. One I'm calling Step 12 Web and one I'm calling Step 12 SQL. So I'm going to start my container and I'm specifying that the Step 12 Web network is being used when I run my ASP.NET Core web application. And then when I run my SQL Server, I'm putting it in the Step 12 SQL network. Now what's going to happen is everything's going to be stood up. Excellent. we'll come back here, we'll refresh. My web application is going to be all fine and dandy, and it's going to be up and running, but it needs to talk to our SQL Server, and it no longer will be able to, because if we give this a moment, any moment now, come on, web application, start up. We won't be logged in because we've destroyed our database, but where previously I went through the registration process, I provide in all my credentials. pal@microsoft.com. Let's see if I can get my password the same. Let's try that without. Okay, there we go. I've typed the password in the same, like, twice. It's amazing how much harder it is to type the same password twice when you know people are watching. Even if I can't see anyone watching, I know there are people watching this. So now my web application is attempting to talk to the SQL Server. It's going, hey, I need access to your database. So we'll also just refresh link pad in the background. But it's going, well, hang on a second. We've got a network error. I can't find a SQL Server at the address that you specified. It doesn't exist. And that's because we're not in the same network. Okay, well, let's hit this hit enter here, and we'll just run through to the next command where I'm doing docker network connect step 12 SQL, so the name of our network, web, the name of our container, and we're going to be adding that web application whilst running to that container, to that network. Now we're going to refresh the page, and what we'll see is the same error that we had previously going, well, I've connected to the SQL Server, but I haven't been able to find the database. So I can now apply migrations. It's going to create the database. It's going to create the tables, and I can now refresh the page, hit continue, and we will be able to successfully register and log in. LinkPad, on the other hand, has timed out. We'll see that we have a network error now when trying to talk to that SQL Server. And no matter how many times I refresh, I'm not going to be able to connect because it has no exposed ports. It isn't in the same network that my laptop happens to be in, so I can't access this. Now, the way that you would then make this accessible is you would have like a jump box that you would connect to, and then you would use that to talk to the SQL Server, the way that you would do a fairly standard DMZ setup. And that's how we can put a level of security by using networks with inside of our Docker environments. I can do that with both a Docker Compose file, or I can do that with just running the Docker commands. And finally, let's jump through to the last set of demos. Now, the name of this talk is called Docker from Scratch. And the reason I call it that is, well, you might have seen in the Docker file, is we use from as the very first command. And we need to use some sort of a base image. Let's just collapse off these and come through to our Docker file that we've got here. Now, KM, and let's just put on our syntax highlighting. Now, Scratch is a Docker file that a Docker base that we can pick. Now, this is a super, super simple parent image. Like, it's technically not an image. Like, you don't pull it from a container registry. It's built into Docker. And what it is it's actually the starting point for everything that you do with Docker images. Everything will ultimately inherit from Scratch. Scratch has nothing in it. It doesn't have a shell. It doesn't have any processes. It is there for complete and utter process isolation to a single process. And let's have a look at how we can use this. I'm just going to put a read command in here to pause my running, and we'll come back. We'll do run. Now, I've decided that I wanted to build like a really basic single binary application. So I've done that with Go. I have a tiny little Go application just up here. All it's going to do is print out a couple of things to the console. I then do Docker run, and I'm actually using a Docker image of Golang to do the build and generate the output because I don't have Go installed on my machine. And then finally, I'm going to use the Scratch and then do a Docker build from that. You can't do a Docker run from Scratch because Scratch isn't like a real sort of image that you could inherit from. Okay, so that's going to be up and running. Fantastic. We're just paused, so we'll split our terminal. I paused at the wrong point. Didn't pause at the wrong point. There should have been some output. Anyway, what I wanted to show is if we do Docker images and have a look at the images that are there, we'll find the Docker from Scratch base image. And if we have a look at the file size of that, 1.5 meg. Compare that to, say, our .NET application here, which is nearly 400 meg. Like, it is tiny, really, really tiny. But that's because it doesn't have anything other than the binary that we output from our Golang build. So Scratch is really good if you're trying to do something that is highly memory optimized and like a really tiny application, but there's a lot of scenarios where it's probably not that particularly useful for. I paused this at the wrong time. Wrong point. Whoops, my bad. Whoa. I should have just done git checkout star to undo all those changes that I accidentally did. And then finally, I want to show one last demo, step 13, 14. Up until now, we've been building something in one container and then putting it onto the mounted file system and then pulling it down there. But what if you want to, you don't want to use the file system as a transient one? And we can actually do that with Docker as well. And that's where we can do multi-stage Docker files. So this is a Docker file with two from statements in it. Only the final from statement, so this block that from line 8 onwards, is going to be the image that we finally publish out. So what's different is that the first one on line 2 here, I'm doing from Golang 1.8 as build. So I'm labeling this internal container that I'm generating with the name build so I can refer back to it. So it's going to do the go build and generate my binary. And then it's going to do from scratch, set the working directory, and then it's going to copy from build instead of from my local directory, the output that I have, and then put it into our container. So that go binary is never going to end up on my host machine. So this could be useful if you're doing tests and you want to do a build test, and then assuming that the test pass, you then publish the image. If the test fails, you don't publish an image. So that's another scenario that you can be using it for. So I'll run that. Did I put my pause in? I think I forgot my pause. I've got some other verbose debugging in there. But what we'll see is that by having a multi-stage, you might be mistaken thinking that we've ended up with a whole bunch of stuff in our final image that we don't need in there. But we'll see in the output, I'm doing a Docker images. We'll see that the output of that, there we go, running our container. Docker from scratch, it's still only 1.5 meg. Whoops. It's tiny. It doesn't. So it just contains that final binary output. Well then, that is 14 live demos of how you can go from the very first Hello World demo through to Docker with Docker through to multi-stage builds, configuring environments, and all sorts of stuff like that. And just some parting words before I have a quick look at the chat. Images are great for experimenting with containers. And maybe with runtimes and languages and stuff like that. They're great for experimenting because you can get rid of them at the end of the day and you don't have to worry about doing uninstalls and stuff like that. Compose is a really useful way to represent an environment, the services that you've got there, the networks you've got, volumes, etc. But you don't need to use Docker Compose. You can, it's just orchestrating the Docker command line. You can use networks to create a DMZ and represent a fairly traditional network structure that you would have with virtual machines, but you can do that with Docker using networking. And Scratch, this talk is Docker from Scratch. Scratch is kind of useful, but not for most sorts of applications that people are going to be building. It's for highly memory constrained or really highly performance sensitive operations. This is where you'll find all of the exercises. There's a wiki on there as well, which explains what happens at each step. They're all done as Git tags, so you just check out the tag as you progress through. I hope that's been interesting. I hope you've enjoyed. I hope you've learned something. So with that, we'll wrap up the talk. My name is Aaron Powell. Again, if you want to find me online, you can find me at Twitter. That's my website, and there's my email address if you want to contact me and ask me any questions. I'm more than happy to do that. So let's just have a quick look at what's happened in the live Q&A. So there's a question around the experience around VS and VS Code with working with Docker, an F5 experience. Yes, actually, you do get that with both VS and VS Code. I've got an article that I've written about how you can set up VS Code for remote debugging of Docker containers, which I will publish out on Twitter. I'll post it on the Reactor Sydney meetup page after this. But yes, you can definitely do it. If you go to my website, you will find that article in there. I talk about it. But yes, you basically have the same F5 debugging experience. In VS, it's exactly the same experience that you've always had with debugging. I see that there was a question around Jack has got in there and answered, and yeah, let's just have a look at all the okay, so Andrew's asked a question around could you SSH into a container? Yes, as long as you've got SSH and you're exposing the appropriate ports, there's you can by all means SSH into a container, because at the end of the day, it's just a Linux system. So whatever you would put into a Linux system, you can stand up SSH in there, SSH server, you can connect to it. You can do SAP copying files and all that sort of stuff in there. But then you're kind of making the container a bit more like a pet rather than a transient thing. So you more want to put stuff into the image, and then you have a very thin layer over the which is the writable file system, and you've got to remember that file system only exists while that container exists. There's another question around are the parent images immutable once they're created? So if you mean from the from statement, and then when you do a Docker run, yes. So an image when it's created is immutable. You can't change what happens in there without creating a brand new image. Because it does a SHA of each layer as it's being generated. So if you change anything in your Docker file, the SHAs are likely to change. When I did the first Docker build, there was a whole bunch of like use cache or from cache, using cache was output to the terminal. And that was because the Docker file, it will try and find layers that have been previously generated and use them rather than create everything every single time. And it looks at by looking at the SHA that could be generated for that layer based off of all its parents. And if it finds one, it will reuse that. So that's a way that you can speed up a build process, is that you, the things that are less likely to change, so the files that you copy in and stuff like that, those are the things that change. So you have those at the last few steps of your Docker file. Everything else you have higher up so that they can be shared across multiple ones. How does SQL Server licensing work with containers? I'm not actually sure, because I've only ever used them for dev containers. I don't actually deploy the SQL Server in production in a container, because I tend to deploy stuff in cloud, so I just run Azure SQL as the SaaS offering, because that way I don't have to worry about backups and network backups and restores and data redundancy and things like that. I use SQL Server predominantly for local development. There will be stuff on MS Docs, so I can find the link out and pop that up on Meetup if you're interested to learn more about what the licensing implications are if you're deploying. But I would always encourage someone, whether it's SQL or Redis or Mongo, look at the SaaS offerings that we've got in Azure to be able to deploy those rather than crafting your own containers to run them. The containers are useful for maybe non-production scenarios. Cool. Well, we're 5 minutes past the hour, and this was only supposed to go for an hour. But so to wrap up the live stream there, thanks everyone for dialing in. And I said, I hope you've enjoyed something. We'll pop the links up on the Meetup page, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.